He exposed a world that most people didn't know existed, the world of bars on shadowy street corners where men danced with men, which was illegal at the time. But because it was so well written and so beautifully expressed, it became literature.
When you slam through my life like a screen door in a hurricane wind,
my solace no denial.
I wanna double my wardrobe, leave the seat up late at night, sing Madonna with an attitude.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. EU bodies divide on expanded queer couples' rights, recounting the lives and careers of a gay literary outlaw, and gender pop, Caribbean cookup, and double wardrobes decorate the audio file. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 27, 2003. The European Union's Council of Ministers this week provisionally approved a directive expanding the recognition of gay and lesbian couples for purposes of travel and residency among the EU member nations. However, the Council's version is notably weaker than the one already approved by the European Parliament, which will have to approve the Council's version for it to become law. The Council members were sharply divided on the EP's proposed full family status for unmarried couples, regardless of gender. The Council's compromise essentially offers little real improvement to gay and lesbian EU citizens and their families, according to ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association. On the plus side, the Council version makes reference to registered partnerships, but it would extend family status to them only in countries that, in its words, treat registered partners equivalent to married couples. That fuzzy definition would apply at most to 7 of the EU's 15 current and 10 prospective member nations. Member nations are asked only to facilitate entry and residence for unmarried partners, another term that ILGA fears is open to interpretation. In the case of couples where one is a citizen of an EU nation and the other is not, another EU nation would be required only to consider, not to accept, the non-EU partner's application to join the EU partner in residence there.
Ireland was one of the Council's strongest opponents to full EU movement rights for same-gender couples, yet there was a significant advance this week within its own borders for gay and lesbian partners. The specific issue was a relatively minor one, but the impact of its resolution is much larger. Ireland pays for citizens over age 65 to travel by bus or train and gives the same travel privileges to those seniors' legally married spouses, even if they're younger. But when the younger partner of a gay senior applied for a travel pass, he was rejected. The unnamed couple turned to Ireland's Equality Authority, which this week ordered the Social and Family Affairs Department to amend its policy to comply with the Equal Status Act, to grant the travel pass, and to pay the unnamed couple £1,500 compensation for discrimination. Equality Authority Chair Neil Crawley called it a very important acknowledgement of the needs and rights of gay and lesbian couples, adding that it has ramifications for other government departments and public bodies. Ireland's National Lesbian and Gay Federation called for a review of all non-statutory government guidelines that may discriminate against gay and lesbian couples.
And Ireland's Anglican bishops have issued a statement calling for a change in the church's traditional position on affirming same-gender relationships from one that rejects homosexual practice of any kind and where marriage between a man and a woman in lifelong union remains the only appropriate place for sexual relationships. The early September pastoral letter called Human Sexuality also acknowledged that homosexual people have held positions of leadership in the church and that their ministry has frequently been highly imaginative and characterized by great pastoral sensitivity that has deeply enriched the lives of those who have experienced it. The main thrust of the letter was that the Church of Ireland's diocesan and general synods, large legislative assemblies, were not the appropriate place for much-needed discussion of gay and lesbian issues, and that given the deep division among Anglicans, experience has shown that it is much more fruitful to spend time on learning how to listen and to grow in understanding than to move rapidly beyond that stage in a desire to reach conclusions as quickly as possible.
That's in stark contrast to the traditionalists among British Anglicans, who met 2,000 strong this week for the National Evangelical Anglican Congress in their biggest gathering in 15 years. The turnout was certainly swelled by the controversial prospect of gay Anglican bishops. U.S. Episcopalians' vote to elevate openly partnered gay Gene Robinson of New Hampshire and their own Church of England's appointment of openly celibate gay Geoffrey John, who withdrew before his consecration for the sake of unity. Theologian Gordon Wenham called support of homosexuality something out of ancient paganism, while conservative leader Vicar David Holloway labeled homosexually active people as modern Jezebels who have to be disciplined, and likened what he called the gay rights people with concentration camp commanders. Some leading evangelicals actually boycotted the opening session to protest the appearance of gay-friendly Archbishop of Canterbury, Ron Williams.
The opposition to Williams has been so intense that an interfaith group of British religious leaders this week issued a letter saying, "We affirm our resolute support for Dr. Williams' endeavors, and we rededicate our efforts to fighting fundamentalism, aggressive proselytism, and homophobia, and to defending the values of tolerance, inclusiveness, and respect for differences, which we all cherish." But while the letter supported an Anglican leader and was explicitly issued on the Jewish New Year Rosh Hashanah, it was most remarkable for its two Muslim signatories. It's believed to be the first time that UK Islamic leaders have publicly denounced homophobia. One, Council of University Imams Chair Muhammad Yusuf, told reporters, "All forms of fundamentalism, whether fundamentalist Islamist or fundamentalist evangelical, are abhorrent to the values of Britain's multi-faith and multicultural society. It is time for the moderate majority of Christians, Jews, and Muslims in this country to lose their wishy-washy liberal image."
In Muslim-dominated Egypt, though, the government persecution of gay men continues. Following the long-running international outcry over the treatment of 52 men arrested in a 2001 raid on a gay-friendly Nile riverboat club, police actions against gays have been less publicized. But Egyptian human rights activist Maher Sabri and other individuals have been spreading the word that in late August, police rounded up another 62 men on Cairo's Kaiser El Nile Bridge, a well-known cruising area. Starting from both ends of the bridge, officers questioned everyone on it and arrested the 62 on debauchery charges. While loading the detainees for transport, police reportedly called out to bystanders, "Look at these faggots."
Africa's Anglican archbishops met this week and responded to the church's gay clergy crisis. The Council of Anglican Provinces of Africa elected to its chair its most outspoken anti-gay member, Primate of Nigeria, Archbishop Peter Akinola. Nigeria is the largest of the Anglican Church's regional provinces with 17.5 million members, and it cut all ties with Canada's New Westminster Diocese after church blessings for gay and lesbian couples were approved there. The council session took a slightly more moderate position. The group declared its opposition to gay clergy, particularly condemning the U.S. Episcopalian's election of Gene Robinson to a bishopric, yet it left the door open for its individual members to take different positions at the upcoming special meeting of the world's Anglican primates in the U.K. Surely the most likely among African leaders to support the Episcopalian's action is Primate of South Africa, Archbishop Jangankulu Ndongani, who has praised the openness of the U.S. Anglicans' process and publicly criticized Akinola's stance.
South African gays and lesbians have won another precedent-setting legal victory for recognition of their relationships. The Supreme Court of Appeal in Bloemfontein in mid-September ordered loss of support compensation from the Public Road Accident Fund for a disabled gay man whose partner died in an auto accident. That reversed a lower court's finding for the fund that the lack of a legal marriage meant that Antoine Michael Duplessis did not qualify for the loss of support from his deceased partner of 11 years, Albert Clack. Appellate Judge Tom Clote claimed his court's inherent power to develop the common law, taking into account the interests of justice, to give effect to the Bill of Rights, and called his ruling an incremental step to ensure that the common law accorded with the dynamic and evolving fabric of our society.
While many fear the worldwide Anglican Communion will schism on the issue of ordaining gays and lesbians, such a split is well underway in Australia's Uniting Church. Their national meeting in July officially opened ordination to partnered gays and lesbians. The church's opposition held a meeting of their own this week in Sydney, with perhaps one-fourth of the delegates announcing they're breaking away to hold their own services in private homes. It's possible those dissidents number in the thousands. They'll continue to collaborate with those remaining in the Uniting Church who are agitating to exclude gays and lesbians from the clergy.
And finally, the collision of gay visibility and marketing has impacted two companies in New Zealand. The venerable Fairydown Clothing, an outdoors equipment firm most famous for supplying Sir Edmund Hillary's Mount Everest climb of a half century ago, has changed its name to Zone. A corporate spokesperson confirmed the change was due to the homosexual connotations of fairy, although Sir Edmund declared that it never bruised my sense of masculinity. Meanwhile, Fags Coffee, that's with two G's, has started a new campaign that bills the brand as the Great Straight Coffee. The company denies this is homophobic and also claims that its line, not as Ponsonby as the name suggests, refers not to Auckland's gay village, but to more pretentious brands of coffee.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 27, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre.
If you remember who I am, the one you choose could be waiting for you in this month's audio file later in the program. Gay novelist John Retchie's powerful influence on American arts and letters could hardly be disputed. A recipient of Lifetime Achievement Honors from both Penn USA West and the William Whitehead Awards, the street hustler cum college professor has written 12 books that could all euphemistically be said to draw on his skill with the sword as well as the pen. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with and solicits a reading by Retchie biographer Charles Casillo.
Today, John Retchie is a respected writer and college professor, but when City of Night, his first book, was published in 1963, its frank exploration of a gay sexual underworld caused a major uproar. The book has since become a literary classic, sitting on the library shelf next to nearly a dozen other books Retchie has written since. Author Charles Casillo has written a biography of the man.
Hi, I'm Charles Casillo, author of Outlaw, The Lives and Careers of John Retchie.
How did you become interested in John Retchie?
I was a teenager, and I was walking through a bookstore, and it was one of those defining moments in life that creative people sometimes have. You see a photograph, you hear a name, you read a passage, and you know it's going to be important. That's what happened to me with John Retchie. I saw a book titled City of Night. For some reason, the title just grabbed me. I started reading it right there and then in the bookstore, and I immediately knew that John Retchie was going to be an important influence on my life. I had never seen the kind of characters he was writing about, these decadent, sort of seedy male prostitutes, drag queens, people into drugs. But he was writing about them with such sensitivity, such a poetic eye. It was the first time that I realized that you can use all of your life experiences, no matter what, no matter how decadent, no matter how controversial, you can use that and through art, transform it into literature.
Let's talk about the impact it had in 1963. There was nothing out there like it.
In American literature, homosexuality was being dealt with in a very veiled, sort of shadowy way with people like Truman Capote and Gore Vidal, but it was never really out there up front. So when the book actually came out, he exposed a world that most people didn't know existed, the world of bars on shadowy street corners where men danced with men, which was illegal at the time, where men wore makeup and dressed as women. This was all nothing that was anywhere near the mainstream. But because it was so well written and so beautifully expressed, it became not only an expose, it became literature and was praised by people like Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal. Although his name may not be known to mainstream audiences as much as we would like it to be, his influence was always there. For example, in the 1980 movie Cruising with Al Pacino, the director based a lot of the encounters of the protagonist of that movie on John Retchie's experiences in leather bars. My Own Private Idaho, Gus Van Sant's film about young hustlers with River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves, by his own admission, was very much influenced by City of Night. The Village People, the song YMCA, is based on a chapter of City of Night, where John Ritchie first came to New York City and stayed at the YMCA. David Bowie, Jim Morrison, David Hockney, they all cite John Ritchie as influences on their work.
Give me sort of a Reader's Digest condensed version of the timeline of his life.
He was born in the early 1930s to Mexican parents who had immigrated from Mexico to El Paso, Texas. And his father was extremely homophobic. In the Latin American culture, they want their sons to be very macho. They want them to be very athletic. And John wasn't like his brothers. I think those early years were very pivotal in his development because he felt so insecure and his father made him feel so worthless. The seeds were planted in him to become great, to excel. But he could never admit to himself or to the people around him his homosexuality because it was so taboo in those days. It was still on the psychiatric books as being a mental illness. And because of the way his father made him feel about anything effeminate, he couldn't admit it to himself. So he went to college. He went into the army. And then he went to New York to further his education. He was 23 years old. And he discovered Times Square. And he discovered the interactions between very young boys and older men. And he thought, this is a way that I could express my sexuality without admitting my homosexuality. If I'm getting paid for it, then I'm not really gay. I'm just doing it for the money. That is an attitude that still prevails today with a lot of hustlers. They use the separation of money from desire so that they could deny any homosexual feelings and say, it's just money. And that's how Ritchie began his long career as a hustler, also gathering information for his books.
Why was Ritchie so obsessed with selling his body, with hustling? Was it narcissism, insecurity? What do you think it was?
I think it was both those things. I think it was narcissism and insecurity. And once again, I don't want to be an armchair analyst, but just from everything I know about him, because his father was always ridiculing him for not being athletic, for not being masculine, for having effeminate qualities, John equated men paying for him with being valuable. It became an obsession with him that people were willing to pay for him. That was one way that, in his mind, he could prove to his father that he had some worth.
Charles Casillo, author of Outlaw, The Lives and Careers of John Ritchie.
After that first day, Ritchie quickly mastered what did and didn't sell on the streets. He discovered that what the men paying for sex usually wanted was the unattainable. The most valued qualities were masculinity and mystery. They wanted their boys to be dumb, uneducated sex objects, like the neighborhood ruffians of their childhood or the aggressive jocks from high school. As a result, Ritchie learned to hide his complicated psychology behind an austere and impenetrable facade. How easy it was to become someone else. My voice would change, my posture would change, my accent would become tougher, he remembers. It was a performance and a good one. I came to feel that I was what I appeared to be at any set time. My appearance changed radically from encounter to encounter. My age, younger. I perceived signals, and I became what they wanted. I see this, and it fascinates and bewilders me in photographs of me taking during that time, that I could look different from moment to moment, depending on the signals given. Although he was nearly 24, Ritchie looked years younger. Many mistook him for a teenager, which made him all the more desirable. But it was Ritchie's inscrutable toughness, his aloof apathy, that made him such a hot commodity on the streets, and that allowed him to survive from season to season with the ever-changing crop of boys. With John, there was never the slightest hint that the act was exchanged for any reason other than money. As he expertly transformed himself into the fantasy, he kept his past, his ambitions, his true character a secret. No matter what he felt for his clients, he remained absolutely detached. Otherwise, the fantasy he created could be broken in an instant. This was a lesson learned very quickly. Once he went home with a client, and as the man undressed, Ritchie leafed through a novel by Colette. "You read?" the man asked incredulously. When Ritchie admitted that, yes, he did read on occasion, the John gave him a fiver and told him to leave. Ritchie grew adept at playing straight. When he was still hustling in his 30s, he told a reporter, "In hustling, I'm often picked up by someone who wants me to be straight, and I get the message right away. If the person asks, for example, 'Have you ever been married?' then I get the signals. And not only will I say yes, which is not true, but I will elaborate on it and say I'm separated now and living with my girlfriend somewhere." When he was just starting out, however, the paradox was that, although he quickly and easily assumed the tough guy exterior, on the inside he was the sensitive boy from El Paso, very much the inexperienced prostitute with the heart of gold.
Charles Casillo, author of Outlaw, The Lives and Careers of John Ritchie. For more information on Ritchie, point your internet browser to johnritchie.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Two gay musicians make their CD debuts, and a former duo becomes an expansion team in this month's Audiophile.
When you slam through my life like a screen door in a hurricane of winds, all I could think was how to find you again. Snowed under, and the roads to the canyon were closed for our safety, I suppose.
Last year, we featured a CD by a duo called Garden Verge. Well, they've added a third member and now go by the name Girly Man. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. The trio is now made up of Tammy Greenstein, Doris Muramatsu, and Nate Borofsky, and their new album is called Remember Who I Am. Nate tells us about their music.
Girly Man is delicious, acoustic, harmony-driven gender pop. That's how I would describe it in one sentence. We sort of came up with our own label before anyone else tried to stick one on us. We wanted something that, where it wouldn't be any kind of a compromise, where we wanted the name to reflect that. And at the same time, it also keeps us from being able to take ourselves too seriously.
Find out more about Girly Man and their CD, Remember Who I Am, at www.girlyman.com. That's www.girlyman.com.
With love divine, my sigh, soul defined by solace, no denying.
The artist calls himself Naj, and he was raised in Guyana.
But now he lives in New York City, and his debut album is called Waiting for You.
My musical style is a combination of a number of styles that I've been exposed to over the years. I grew up in the Caribbean, and so there's a very Caribbean/reggae vibe going on. I also grew up in church, so there's also kind of Christian/gospel feel. As I, became a teenager, I listened to a lot of the pop music that was on the radio. So it's everything kind of cooked up. Like, let's say in the Caribbean, it's like a cook-up. So, styles.
More love. We need more love. More love. More love. More love.
You can learn more about the album Waiting for You by Naj at www.naj.com. That's www.nhojj.com.
Another debut artist is Stephen Franz from Miami, Florida, with his album called The One You Choose.
It's an album about self-awareness, relationships, and doubling your wardrobe.
There are so many reasons. Draw the line, close the window. You can hide.
Honestly, as I started the process, my goal was just to create something very musical, very reflective of my style, my influences, and one of the most special gifts, I guess you could call it, that I got at that time was a song called Double My Wardrobe. Literally, I was sitting in the same seat I'm sitting in here in my living room and just got on my guitar, and the first line just came to me, this is my story and I'm sticking to it.
This is my story and I'm sticking to it, no matter what people say. So listen, mommy, and listen, daddy, your little boy, well, he's not straight. And I don't know where this came from, all I know is I'm feeling good about myself. So don't think that you failed me, or believe that I need help, just because I wanna double my wardrobe, leave the seat up late at night, sing Madonna with an attitude.
Find out more about Stephen Franz and his debut album, The One You Choose, at www.stephenfranz.com. That's www.stephenfranz.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas, 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Fenceberry, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Steve Pride, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. The Village People performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, or for audio cassette subscription information, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And thanks to Alternabid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at alternabid.com. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2BOB Taree, New South Wales, WTIP Grand Marais, Minnesota, KUOI Moscow, Idaho, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We invite you to stay tuned.